The committee would come to order, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. It is Monday, March 6th. Members, well, the entire committee is here, so we do have quorum. We've got three CSs to consider today. Let's first take up Senate Bill 274. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
First of all, before you start, Senator, we do have a proposed CS that is based on the discussion that we had in committee previously. If I could have a motion on the /I version.
I'd move /I.
Senator Wagner's moved /I. Is there objection? Seeing none, that will be the working document before the committee. Now, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. This is a bit of a work in progress, and on one level, I can be embarrassed that I haven't worked out some of these details with Department of Public Safety. It's certainly not our intention to put a big burden on those guys. My goal with this bill was to make, to the degree we could, make sure that no guns are destroyed that are in the possession of the Department of Public Safety. And the few guns that they get that are quote illegal, most of those can be sold to a class 3 dealer, their machine gun or sawed-off shotgun or so on, which there's quite a number of those folks in the state. I want the department to be able to continue to do what they're doing, get maximum value, including what they're doing that I think is really neat, and that's they're trading used guns to a dealer for new ones that they need for their duty, and I think that's the kind of initiative that we ought to be delighted to see. I don't think they're taking it, doing anything sneaky with that. And I want non-dealers to be able to buy the firearms just like they can at a store or a gun show. And that, of course, is all of the legal guns. And at the gun shows and at stores, if you're, they do a background check and that all works well, and there's no reason why the Department of Public Safety can't do that as well at an auction, just as we do at the gun shows. And finally, our research has shown, and we have legal opinions, that the Department of Public Safety incurs no more liability in selling a used firearm than they do a truck or a loader or anything else. There's nothing, or any other kind of power tools, whatever. There's no increased liability to the state. And I'm hoping that out of this, the Department of Public Safety will realize that they don't need to have been jumping through the hoops they have been in order to not expose the state to more liability. So those were our intentions. And I'm hoping that if you will allow me, I could join you and we can interact here a bit with Department of Public Safety and see how we can work out this, what their view on the issues that I've just raised.
Okay, so do we have somebody here with the Department of Public Safety?
Chairman, for the record, I'm Dan Spencer, Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Public Safety. The Commissioner and I have previously met with Senator Dyson's staff and addressed a couple of the concerns, and Senator Dyson just brought up one of those, which is what we are very reluctant to do is see removed from us our ability to trade in surplus weapons. To acquire new weapons. Twice since 1996, we have had situations where we have reached an agreement with a firearms manufacturer. In 1998, it was Smith & Wesson. In 2002, it was Glock. And we did a complete changeover of our service weapons for the troopers. And in the case of the 2002 ones, we got about 436 Glock 40 caliber firearms. along with holsters, magazines, extra magazines, and magazine pouches, and these are law enforcement magazines. And we got those at no cost to the state by taking the weapons that we already had, our duty weapons, as well as the confiscated or recovered but unclaimed firearms, and traded them in. That had a value for us of about $227,000. So if we were compelled to forfeit that opportunity, that would have to be a capital appropriation for us to be able to do that. The one other thing that could come in there, although I don't think it would be situations where we would have a warranty issue, but I think we would probably not consider those to be surplus firearms at that point. Senator Dyson, in his earlier comments, talking about working with us to ensure that we don't lose the ability to trade our existing serviceable firearms in or service weapons. We appreciate that. We'd be happy to work with him on that. As far as the disposal of the other firearms that we may have, right now we have about 500. I should point out to the committee that will also involve the Department of Administration. By statute, the Department of Administration is charged with disposing of surplus state property. And what we have done for both of our trade-ins in the past is we've gotten a written approval from a waiver of the normal sale process from the Department of Administration and Chief Procurement Officer Vern Jones. So we could work with that. As far as the liability issue, we were concerned about that. That's also, I know, a concern of the Department of Administration. And if Senator Dyson has talked to folks and that's not an issue, then we can work through on that also. A couple of things. As I understand amendment or subcommittee substitute backslash I, and I have a draft here, I think, from last week. It would basically amend the existing bill by either requiring donation of a confiscated or surplus or illegal firearm to a museum, or require, as Senator Dyson mentioned here earlier, to take it and separate it into parts. And determine which parts are legal or safe, sell those, and not sell the other ones. Quite frankly, we would probably be inclined to just give them to the Department of Administration and have them bring on a gunsmith to do that. I mean, we're not in the business of parting out weapons that we're not familiar with. I mean, we take care of our own weapons. Right now, the process basically is that we have an armorer, if you will, with the Alaska State Troopers, comes over. He gives them a look over, but it's not an extensive look over. I mean, obviously, if it's a sawed-off shotgun, it's illegal. Machine gun, we're not going to be selling that to the general public either. And as long as we're trading it in, we wouldn't trade firearms that the tradee, if you will, could not, or trader could not accommodate. But the decision as to whether or not a particular part of a firearm is safe or unsafe is beyond what we would have as expertise for all the various firearms out there. One other thing that this applies to, and we shouldn't skip over, I think, is ammunition. I've had the luxury of some time to think about this. Right now, what we do for the most part with ammunition is we give it to our academy and they make the decision, are they going to dispose of it. I'm not a gunsmith. I've been around them for, 50 years. But a lot of times you can't tell just by looking at a casing whether or not that's a safe. Do you want to put that in a weapon and try firing it or not? I think the issue of ammunition we should probably talk about a little bit more. I mean, you can look at some ammunition just like some firearms and say, it's pitted, it's got a hole in it or something else, clearly not salvageable. But other stuff, even though it looks good, you might not want to go there. So with that, Mr. Chairman, those are our concerns. And like I say, be happy to work with Senator Dyson on further changes to the legislation.
Senator Dyson.
Thanks. Dan, I appreciate the testimony. Realizing that most, like a sawed-off shotgun or a fully automatic weapon, could be sold to a Class 3 dealer, what are the other weapons that you sometimes show up in your inventory that are illegal. The only thing I can think of is the ones with defaced serial numbers, but what else? And maybe cannons or something.
We have seen firearms in the past, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, that have had the that have been modified so that they can be fully automatic.
Yeah.
You know, instead of semi-automatic. That's a common issue that we see. That's the only one I can think of right off the top of my head. You know, shortening the barrel is, as you say, a pretty common thing there. You know, and we've seen some that have been converted to commando style, you know, which involves both putting on folding stocks, making them more concealable, and those kind of issues, where they may not necessarily be completely illegal, but you take what was a long arm, you know, and convert it to something that is much more a concealable weapon.
Yeah, and I appreciate it, but those are fully legal for every citizen to own, and I personally don't want that to restrain you from selling it to citizens who have not been disqualified from owning and having that.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, one other thing I would point out is that there will still be, even if we work out an agreement and you were to modify the bill to where we could trade in our service weapons, there would still be some cost because these weapons have also been included in those trades in the past. And so there would still be some cost, but for the most part, we're not talking, I think, probably nearly the value that we are. Because when we trade in firearms, they're well maintained, you know, they're good value, our service weapons.
Yeah. So if. You've introduced something that I hadn't thought about and probably should have, but that is that Department of Administration ends up doing the disposal, and we will talk with them, and there would be some work for them, and I would anticipate that, you know, that they would probably do, as you said, hire a gunsmith to take apart the ones that need to be, and also if we have wondered if there should be a signed document of disclaimer, you know, that to make even more clear to the recipient that the state is not only not warranting that it's safe, you know, and so on, but assumes no responsibility. I think that doesn't make any real difference, but maybe it does helps the recipient realize.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things we had thought about doing, and we have another amendment that would force you into a very rigorous inventory and report and so on, and I'm not sure that the commissioner shares my enthusiasm for private citizens having all the weapons that I do, but I do trust his integrity. What I worry about is another administration further out, you know, that just cheerfully goes ahead destroying legal and valuable weapons just as a matter of public policy, and there's no mechanism for us to know, you know, what they all would be doing at some future date. And I'm reluctant to put an odious inventory reporting requirement on you guys because I trust you, but I'd enjoy your thinking about how we could structure what we're doing to preclude a less ethical group from doing that which I don't want done.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, I won't speculate on what future folks might do. I will say I think there are probably a couple of ways that could be modified to make it more palatable to the department. I can think of a couple offhand, and it's not before us, so I won't go there right now. I will say that, you know, there have not been, I think since certainly in the last 5 or 6 years, which predates my experience with the department, I've been there for a little over 2 years, there have only been 10 firearms destroyed, and those were as a test of a particular method of you know, taking a carbide tip saw and literally cutting them up, and that was far more work than it was worth, quite frankly. And so, but I think there are ways to address some of those concerns. And certainly, we would prefer not to be publishing an inventory of just exactly what it is we've got out there as sort of a shopping list for people that are interested in acquiring something like that until there was a sale available.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dan, thanks for your testimony. I'm curious about a provision in the sponsor substitute or committee substitute on the first page where it provides that if state or federal law prohibits the department from selling a particular firearm, the department shall either donate the firearm to a museum or dismantle the firearm and sell the legal parts. I'm just wondering if we shouldn't define museum a little bit more. I mean, an accredited museum or something. I'm just a little bit concerned about, I don't know if we have them in our state, but roadside museums where a person, you know, has a gift shop on one side or part of a museum of, that displays different artifacts. I assume that it gives because there is a choice, either donating or dismantling, that the department wouldn't do that anyway. But maybe you could speak to the issue of whether we need to further define museum.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Elton, I think that's a fair point. I think also the Department of Administration needs to weigh in on this also. I mean, certainly the roadside museum of machine gun firing probably isn't something we'd be doing. I mean, I don't know if there is an accepted definition out there. So I'm simply, that would be one we'd have to explore further with Senator Dyson.
And the issue of, you know, the trade-in that the department gets, if you sold the vehicle or sold the weapons, of course, there's a program receipt that comes in too. Do you think you get more value in the trade-in process than you would at sale? And of course, if you do the trade-in, all of that value, that's a deal that you strike with the supplier. There's no money that's going through the general fund. Whereas if you sell the weapons, that money accrues to the general fund, then it has to be appropriated back. But it's still, which one do you think results in the higher value?
Mr. Chairman, that's a tough one because in large part it rests on assigning a value to the inventory of seized or recovered weapons as opposed to our surplus, you know, the weapons that we've got that are service weapons. From a general point of view, if we have to go out and I think probably trading in our service weapons, we get a very good value from the manufacturers. I mean, we're talking about folks that do business with police agencies and whatnot all over the world, and there's some value to them to keep that kind of a client involved, and I think we get a pretty good deal there. I simply cannot speculate on what we would get if we went to auction with the other firearms. You know, I've seen the firearms that we've got. Some of them, quite frankly, just like you'd expect, look pretty darn good in terms of going out and selling them. Some of them, they don't look like much at all. And the Department of Administration, it's my understanding, has submitted a fiscal note, and it does include, I think, the a cost of having a gunsmith, and it does show a net revenue, I think, if you don't include the cost that we would have to go by going out and buying firearms. But that was based on an earlier version of the bill and without this trading in surplus weapons.
Okay. On that point.
Go ahead, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. When we see your budget in Finance Committee, do we see the value gained from the sale of the surplus property as a line item?
No, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson, you didn't. Right.
And that might be a part of the solution. And I assume that when you do that transaction, you know, every 3 or 4 years or whatever it is, that there is a physical inventory that, and so copying that to to the Finance Committee would not be a burden hardly at all. And, right? And I suspect Senator Huggins have a catalog you can buy every year of current gun values, and you can run down through there and fairly quickly see if they're in the ballpark on what the value we're getting. And that would give us a little check to see if you guys are giving away the farm or, you know, doing a pretty good job of that. And so that might be the kind of thing that we could look at. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, is it Ben or Dan?
Dan.
Dan. Sorry, Dan, I couldn't hear you real well. Dan, thanks for being here today. You know, I will talk to you in a moment about a thing that I would call goodwill in this case. But before I get to that, how many weapons, sidearm-type weapons, do you have in the department?
We have roughly 500 that are service weapons of one type or another.
Okay. And you said you did a trade-in in 96 or 8 and in 2001?
2002.
Right. And you did roughly 250 each time?
The value was what we did. Actually, we did in 2002, we got 436 firearms, and we can provide to the committee a list of what we traded in, but it was roughly a one-for-one.
Right. So you were updating the...
That's correct. We were taking used firearms, service weapons, trading them in, being brand new ones, so it's the value of the used firearms that we traded in, plus these seized and disposed firearms.
Right. And I think we all support, you know, our in this case, our troopers having the best for their own protection and our protection. But do you think it's fair to say that the average trooper probably gets more vehicle wear on his weapon and holster wear than he does from shooting it, so they're not worn out? They're essentially new, other than rub marks from...
Senator, I don't know. I mean, the reality is...
Well, let me put it another way. How many rounds do you think are troopers required to fire through their weapon in an annual period?
I don't have that information. I can certainly get it to you.
No, it's not that important. I just, yeah. My assumption, they're relatively new other than some surface wear on them, but I may be incorrect. I will now get to my point of goodwill. That the goodwill factor, I think, is important for us. I mean, this past weekend, I was at a gathering of great Alaskans, flag waving and people doing things a lot of us at this table are very familiar with. It was called a gun show. Mm-hmm. In Palmer, Alaska. Drew people from North Pole and Greeley and Soldotna. I don't think I saw anybody from Juneau, but there were certainly people from around. And there was one thing that multiple people stopped me about was this bill, Fred Dyson's bill, because they saw it. And I guess if I was to characterize their attitude was, why won't those guys in the Department of Public Safety sell some of their weapons? And I said, I don't know. And one guy told him about, you know, my looking at Senator Dyson's bill. And he said, you know, that's a good thing because, you know, we will recycle some of. And I characterize that in the viewpoint of the people that I talked to, who was probably half a dozen, that the goodwill factor of they're certainly law-abiding, supporting law enforcement kinds of activities, but that confirming aspect of the skepticism of, well, they just cut them up, whatever the case may be, go to Ruger or go to Glock or whomever it might be. I think the goodwill factor of recycling them through the system, like Senator Dyson is proposing here, is one worthy of note for us. Now, when is the last time that the department has disposed of any weapons back to the public?
Senator, I don't know that. I do not know.
And you know, this hasn't been of great interest to me, but it has to multiple people, and I hadn't followed up as far as I probably should have, but I would venture to say that when Senator Dyson got a readout from the Attorney General about the liability factor, that the department could have come across that just as easily, if you will. My point, one more time, is that the goodwill factor of recycling weapons to some degree to the public, I think, is well beyond the dollar signs that might be attached to any given weapon, that in my estimation probably has a little surface wear and not much use from firing 40 or 50 millimeter through the barrel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Do you have any response?
Mr. Chairman, if I might. Senator Huggins, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you in one sentence why we haven't disposed of firearms regularly, and that's we're not a gun seller. That's not our purpose in life, and as we've discussed, there are, when you get into the sales, there are a variety of things, and since we've had the ability to leverage the trade, you know, for these things, that's what we have done, and certainly the question of whether or not we should do that is a question for you, this committee, and this legislature. We do very much understand the issue of goodwill. We do know that this is an issue with folks, and although I wasn't at the department the last time and there was a destruction of firearms, I certainly remember reading the headlines and listening to my father talk to me about it, because he has the same catalog that you and Senator Dyson apparently have with all the prices. So
yeah, well, if I might, Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. I mean, I think we have to, the goodwill factor, if we think of the people that were, that this would be of interest to and would be appealing, that a previous administration, the head of it, I remember reading all the headlines, and it was given to cutting up firearms, okay? And to some people out there, the fact that they never see them again after they go to your department is the equivalent of that, because they don't know where they go. I couldn't answer that to them, the fact that they were being traded in. Now, maybe I should have known that answer, but there are still some skeptics, and they're good people, and they're good law-abiding people, and I think that it's not my place, not your place, and some others in this room to decide whether or not the recycling happens to them or not. Thank you.
It seems to me that the headlines previously were when the firearms were destroyed. It wasn't an issue of whether, in fact, that the state had a trade-in and got good value for the department. Yes. And so what we have to balance is, you know, that value that accrues to the Department of Public Safety and who we want to be well-equipped and out there doing the job that we have them on the street to do, versus the chance that a usable firearm is just destroyed and not usable for anybody. So, Senator Huggins, I wasn't sure from your comments whether you think that value or goodwill component with the public would mandate that we sell a firearm to the general public and perhaps only get 75% of the value that we could have gotten if we had gone back to the manufacturer as part of a trade-in.
Yeah, that may be a good investment. That's exactly what I'm saying. That may be a good investment. And my assumption is it probably is not that large a disparity, because the value of these weapons that essentially have some surface wear on and not anywhere down the barrel is pretty high. And I mean, the people that are manufacturers, they don't do that for their health. They're making money off of this.
Is there further questions? Senator Allen.
Just a comment. This is a part of my sordid history, probably, Mr. Chair, which was an editor. And I'm wondering if Dan or the sponsor, on page 1, line 9, it says, the state or federal law prohibits the department from selling a particular weapon. And I given Dan's testimony that it may not be the department that sells, but it could be the Department of Administration that sells, I wonder if better language wouldn't just be if state or federal law prohibits the selling of a particular firearm rather than saying the department, because there could be problems about, you know, whether this law applies to the Department of Public Safety but not to the Department of Administration.
I'm sorry, is that page 1, line 12?
Page 1, line 9.
Line 9, right? Line 9?
Line 9. Yeah. Just strike department from.
We'll look at that.
Okay. So you want to just raise that as a point?
Just raising it as a point for the I'm assuming this bill isn't moving today and that the sponsor's going to be working on it.
Okay, yes, the sponsor has asked that the bill be kept in committee at this time. So, Senator Dyson, is there anything else that you think needs to be discussed at this point?
No. Thank you for both your courtesy and the work.
Okay, we'll hold Senate Bill 274. Let's go next to House Bill 167. Or, no, 279. We'll do Senate Bill 279. 297, excuse me. Okay. And we are going to have Heather, committee staff, walk us through the proposed CS, if I could just get a motion on the backslash L version. Senator Wagner?
I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 297 backslash L version.
Okay, that's L as in Lima. Without objection, that'll be the working document before the committee. Heather, why don't you take us through the changes that were made?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the CS, the last time this bill was in front of the committee, there were some questions concerns expressed. One of the changes that we made was on page 2, line 1, a contribution to an organization may be, and I believe the previous version had 10, it was as low as $10 could be contributed. And there was some question about whether or not that was cost effective to allow an amount that low. What we did was change this so that it started at 50 after the sponsor thought about that some more. There may be a wish to add back in a $25 amount if the committee wishes to do that. The next change is on same page, line 5. And what we've done here is allowed that the applicant in the application process could prioritize the contributions to the organization so that if they decided to contribute their entire dividend, not knowing what that amount was at the time of application, they could prioritize their contributions, and those in that order would be contributed to those organizations. Line 24, there has been concern from the division as well as the United Way and the Rasmussen Foundation to change September 1 as being the date that an organization would have to apply to the division by September 1 to be included on the list for the following January. And that date may be too far out, so they would ask that the committee amend that to August 1, and I guess that would go, line 17 would need to be amended also to say August 1. Page 3, line 10, we've added in if the organization's annual budget exceeds $250,000, we had an audit requirement, and we've asked that the audit have an unqualified opinion after speaking with Pat Davidson at the Legislative Audit Division. She recommended adding that verbiage in, which essentially means that there are no internal control weaknesses in the organization. Line 21 through 27, we've added in, after speaking with OCS Division, I asked them what happens when there's a child in custody and that state agency is responsible for applying for the annual dividend of those children, of which they said there's about 2,500 of them in state custody every year. I asked if it if they had any current regulations or somewhere in statute, did it prohibit the division from electing to put 50% of the child's dividend in the college savings fund, which is now an option on the application, and they said no. So we've added something in here that says if there's a child in state custody, then the agency or whomever is applying for that dividend may not elect to contribute the dividend away. And then also we've added in a requirement for reporting each year so that we have an idea of how much is being elected to be contributed and to what organizations.
Okay. Do we have questions from the members? At this point, I would like to move an amendment on page 2, lines 17 and 24 to change the date there from September 1st to August 1st. Has been indicated there's some question on whether the September would allow enough time. Sharon, did you want to come forward and make a comment on this, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sharon Barton, Permanent Fund Dividend Director. When I testified last time that I thought that time period would be too short, I hadn't yet heard from the United Way, who might be handling this for us through for the first year or so through the Rasmussen Foundation. Last week, I did have an opportunity to talk with them a little bit more and get their fiscal note for the bill. And they, their assumption in the fiscal note and built in those numbers are represented in the current fiscal note required a 10-month lead time on those applications for processing them through to a list. So if we're going to print with or to the printer with our draft of the application booklet in mid-October, you can see that a 10-month lead time would mean January or so for application. Now, they did comment that at a higher cost in the fiscal note for putting on more staff to deal with it, they could probably shorten that timeline, but I don't have their assessment of at what cost and how short. So I think we need more information on this piece of it, but clearly they'll need a little more time than we've envisioned to process through the numbers of applications they're envisioning receiving for the program.
And that was the United Way organization? I guess.
Mr. Chairman, I was speaking with Michelle Brown, who was asked by Rasmussen to put together costs for doing all the solicitation of the organizations for the list, processing the applications, and then putting the list together and then distributing the money to those organizations later. I've not heard from Diane Kaplan of the Rasmussen Foundation to know what their thinking is on it. We have not connected.
Mm-hmm. So do you think moving to August at this time is still not going to be early enough or not allow enough lead time, or it's preferable to September 1st?
Mr. Chairman, I think it wouldn't help much. If their estimate is correct, I can imagine them cutting that 10 months in half, perhaps, by putting more staff on. But I don't know how much better they could do than that. And that would be 5 months lead time from October 15th. So that's our drop-dead date for getting the copy to the printer. So
Okay. Well, then, at this point, then I'll just withdraw my amendment. Just leave it at September, and we'll, in the process here, we'll hope to hear from them soon. Let's see, there, one other question that had been brought up is whether this money that would accrue to, potentially accrue to a school district, would impact their local contribution requirement, and it does not. But in addition, the PTAs and whatnot were, they're not 501c3s. Is that right, Heather? And so in this draft, we have dropped them out because they're C4s and C6s. Correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So I think the change that, you know, the audit not have any qualifications, that makes sense. Qualification basically is a red flag on an organization, and we wouldn't want to be funneling money to an organization that's got some questionable internal procedure. They need to correct that before they could participate. Requiring a list of who's on the list and what money they've been able to generate, I think that's information the state will, legislature will want. Not allowing a state, somebody in state personnel to check their favorite contribution on some minor's application certainly makes sense. There's the issue of whether we wanted to add back a $25 contribution. And then there are also, I know the Rasmussen Foundation still is interested in having the paper application, but I think for myself, I think rather than incur that expense, and I'm just trying to imagine how, you know, potentially hundreds of qualifying applications or organizations on the paper list and what that does to the cost of the application and handling all that paper is something that I would like to avoid. Certainly the legislature can see if the numbers of people going to the electronic submission continues to grow, and once we get, you know, through one or two cycles, the legislature may consider adding in the paper, but I think at this point it would be my preference to keep it to the electronic application. So with that, are there other questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, if we're ready, then we'll, I'd entertain a motion on the CS. Somebody want to make a motion?
Let me get back to it. You want to make a motion to adopt the CS?
To from move it from
or committee. Move it from yeah. committee. We've already adopted it.
Yeah.
I'd move CS for State Bill 297, State Affairs /L, from committee with individual references
and the attached fiscal
recommendations note. And the attached fiscal note.
Without objection, then.
Could I ask the question before
sure.
we start the motion?
Yeah, it would.
Where is this supposed to go past here?
It goes to finance.
And you were saying that the things that are not worked out should be worked out in finance? Because I thought you would say you were waiting to get an answer back from?
Before requesting a hearing up in finance, I'll hold the bill until we get the input from United Way on exactly how much lead time they need. Okay. So without objection, the CS will be forwarded up to finance for their consideration with the attached fiscal note. Brings us to the final bill, and that is House Bill 167. And Heather, see. I move at this time that we adopt, for purpose of committee discussion, the /L version. Without objection, that will be the working document before us. Heather, why don't you walk us through the changes that we have before us?
Mr. Chair, before that, /L, or I've got an IA.
L.
I'm sorry, Heather.
Yeah, the date is March 3rd.
/L.
L.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
You have it? Everybody have it?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you refresh our memory on where we were with questions and amendments last time and what changes have been made.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Heather Brake, staff to Senator Terrio. The committee substitute makes several changes to the version that we considered a few days ago. First of all, on page 2, line 22, there was some question about the death certificate being provided at no cost to an individual, a qualified or eligible individual, for a deceased veteran. And at that time, the committee discussed limiting the number of no-cost certificates to the group or the pool of individual recipients, and limiting the number to 5 for the purpose of cutting down some of the cost to the Division of Vital Statistics. And after speaking to Mr. Mitchell, who testified previously, the fiscal note that was submitted on behalf of Vital Statistics already had based their figures on an average of 5 per deceased veteran. So in that respect, us limiting the number doesn't do anything to the different to change that fiscal note or fiscal impact to the division. After working with the drafter, he suggested that putting in language to have the certificate given to an individual for the purpose of satisfying an eligibility requirement for a benefit related to the death of the veteran may avoid some of the problems that were seen in terms of who could come in and request it. What if it was the distant cousin who came in and requested the certificate, and then the family's left without not being able to get the death certificate for purposes of settling an estate or establishing the status of the veteran? So that's one change you see on page 2, lines 22 through 26. Second, after reviewing the definition of veteran that was adopted in the original bill that you heard, it wasn't inclusive enough to apply to someone who is in service, but maybe died in service. The way that the wording was is that to be a veteran, you had to have been discharged. So it left out those individuals killed in combat or even in a car accident. They wouldn't have qualified. There were also some differences of residence. One piece of that definition said you had to have been here, you had to have lived in Alaska for a year before you died. And so what we've tried to do is recraft that language to be as inclusive as possible, and you'll see that on page 3, lines 14 through 21, so that they could have been on active duty at the time of death, they could have been in service at the time of death. We tried to reconcile the differences between the Alaska Scouts and the Alaska Territorial Guard, adding those in, and just saying that they were a resident at the time of death. So we made those changes, and the only other...
Heather.
Yes, sir.
While we're there in that part, Mr. Chair, I would like to move a friendly amendment on line 17. We have Alaska Army National Guard, but we don't have air, so we just add Alaska Air National Guard as one of the items, and that'll make it fully inclusive.
And Heather, do you know, is there any reason that wasn't in there, or just oversight, you think?
Probably oversight.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, when speaking with the drafter, oh, I see Naval is here. I don't know.
Yeah, it has to be Air National Guard.
Okay.
I mean, there's two components.
Army Navy.
Okay.
Okay, and so Senator Huggins, again, just on line 17, include Alaska Air National Guard?
Right.
Is there any objection to that? Seeing none, we'll make that change.
Mr. Chair.
And Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I apologize to the Chair and Heather, because I think this was heard when I was in a resource committee meeting, and there may have been discussion of, about it. Was there any discussion about the Coast Guard, who often serves in war zones, is now part of the Department of Homeland Security, but I don't believe it was.
That's you're right, because that's, it says reserve units, and it doesn't say, but it's got active duty, so it, and reserve, so it takes care of those. Is active duty, and then the other one, reserve unit, the very last part, or a reserve unit, in other words, if you're a Coast Guard reserve person, so those two are inclusive.
But I guess I'm wondering about the definition of a branch of the armed services, since Coast Guard is in Department of Homeland Security and not under the Department of Defense, would they be?
No, you're right.
And this may have been discussed at the previous meeting, Mr. Chair.
No, I don't remember Coast Guard in particular being discussed. So, Senator, would you like to move another amendment then for that definition?
I would. I'd like to make it maybe conceptual, because I'm not sure, as Senator Huggins has suggested, they also have an active reserve, and so I'm not exactly sure. So a conceptual amendment that we add Coast Guard and any reserve unit that that may be involved. And I'd move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there objection to that? Seeing none. We'll work with the drafters to figure out the appropriate language to add in the Coast Guard and Coast Guard Reserve. Okay, Heather, had you completed all your statements then?
Mr. Chairman, one other question for the committee to consider is an immediate effective date. After speaking with the sponsor, because this would not become effective until some 90 days after it was signed into law, there may be instances where we have people who have been killed in service or combat who may need to receive a certified death certificate sooner than this would become effective. So. That's just something for the committee to consider.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that. Of course, that would entail a title change, which means we'd have to have a title change resolution.
I will check with the drafters. It's my understanding that just to add an effective date, we would not need the title change resolution, but I will.
I think we do.
Okay.
But
I'll check.
Well, let's check on that. And any opposition from the committee members as far as putting in an immediate effective date? Seeing none, then I will move amendment number 3, which would be to add an immediate effective date, and just with the knowledge that that may trigger then a separate resolution for a allowance of a title change, which I don't think there would be any problem with. So. Okay, anything else? We have the prime sponsor, Representative Lynn. Did you have some comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, I would just indicate I think the changes that have been made are just excellent.
Okay. Okay. Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, just a question for the sponsor. Bob, the fiscal notice, and we agreed last time to have that based on 5 death certificates. My assumption, there's a large number of people that will only need 1 or 2. Whether a numbering mechanism that works for us to be able to reduce the physical note that makes sense rather than inflating and have it. Does that make sense to you? In other words, the physical note is based on 5 death certificates.
The current physical note is. Now, we have modified the language so that it's not cut off at 5. It just says if you need the death certificate to apply for a benefit, you'll be able to get it.
Right.
So I think that that's likely to change or cause the agency to relook at the fiscal note before it's taken up in finance. However, I'm not sure if they're going to have a way of looking back at the average being five and telling us whether they know that of those five, two of them on average are needed to apply for a benefit, or, you know, so there's likely to be, in fact, what it may do is trigger the fiscal note to be recast as an indeterminate.
Yeah.
But likely to be less cost, but just indeterminate. So, are there any other issues to come before the committee? Seeing none, why don't we have a final motion on House Bill 167. Senator Wagner.
I would move Senate CS for House Bill number 167 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Without objection, the bill will be moved from committee. Thank you for making time in your schedule today. And with that, we are adjourned. And